This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, comic Neil Brennan, is mostly known for being a behind-the-scenes guy. With Dave Chappelle, he co-created and co-wrote the sketch comedy series Chappelle's Show. And he co-wrote a sketch for Saturday Night Live when Chappelle hosted just after Donald Trump was elected president. Brennan has directed episodes of Inside Amy Schumer. He wrote some material for Seth Meyers' 2011 performance at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Now he's working with The Daily Show. But Brennan is also stepping out more as a performer. He has a new comedy special on Netflix called Three Mics. He literally works with three different microphones. One mic is for his one-liners, one for stand-up, and one for more personal stories about things like depression and his family. Let's hear a clip from the stand-up section.
I hang out with a lot of black dudes. Yeah, white people are always like, what's it like? It's like, we don't do anything crazy. We just, like, eat and talk. Like, I don't have to rap. Let's play a game called Sounds Racist, Isn't Racist. Ready? Such a horrible setup for a white person to give. No, here it is. There have been a lot of good slave movies lately, right? Sounds racist. I just enjoy them as movies. You guys think I'm like, think it's a documentary. I get it. Here's what I've learned hanging out with black dudes. When a new slave movie comes out, can't be your idea as the white person to go see it. Can't be like, have I got a movie for us? Follow me. Hi, could I get 14 for Django, please? Thank you. Slavery is such a big deal. It's such a big deal. If I were black, I would talk about it constantly. I really would. And a lot of white people go, well, I think black people talk about slavery too much as it is. First of all, if Italians went through slavery, they'd never shut the up about it. You know that. You know it. And they'd all have some heroic story of escape too. Like, so finally, my Uncle Fabrizio was like, he wants a slave master. And he walked from North Carolina straight to Jersey. All right. I would talk about it constantly. Constantly. Like, if I were black and waiting tables, I'd be like, all right, guys, here's your check, and don't forget, slavery. If a cop stopped me and he's like, you know why I pulled you over? I'd be like, to apologize for slavery.
Neil Brennan, welcome to Fresh Air. So in your show, you're the guy on stage, you're the guy behind the mic or the mics, but really you had become best known for being a behind-the-scenes guy, writing for Chappelle's show, directing Amy Schumer's show. And so how did you start going back on stage and doing stand-up?
Well, I did stand-up a little bit during Chappelle's show, and then when Dave left and the show ended, I just sort of felt like I didn't want to do stand-up because I felt like people would just be yelling, like, where's Dave, you know? So I waited a few years, and then I started back up in, like, 2007. The way Chappelle's show ended, I felt sort of, like, you know, bereft, and I felt like, oh, wow. Like, when you do a show with someone else, you're kind of totally dependent on you're at their, you know, beck and call, and it's their whims, you know? So if you're doing a show with Dave and he decides he doesn't want to do the show anymore, there's kind of nothing you can do about it. So I felt like I need to be more self-determining, and the most self-determining thing you can do in comedy is just do stand-up. And I had a lot of stuff that I wanted to, I had a lot of stuff I wanted to say too, and I had more of an output than just sketches.
Well, I'm going to ask you about a sketch that you did with Chappelle, but I want to ask you about writing with him for the show. You co-created the show as well as co-writing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the sketches were about race. And so you were like the white person writing from a black point of view. Were there times it was uncomfortable to be a white person writing sketches from a black point of view in the sense that there's always comedy you're allowed to do, for instance, about Jews, but only if you're Jewish, or about gay people, but only if you're gay, or about black people, but only if you're black. I could go on.
No, please do. What else? There was never, it wasn't too awkward because it was just me and him. So it was like, I was never making, it was more just like pitching jokes. Like, hey, how about this? How about this? You want to do this? You want to do that? It was never, I would never take big swings in terms of racial jokes. Like, you know, hey, you know, black people do this. It was never that sort of bald. It was more like a premise, and then we would sort of know. And a lot of what we did was make fun of white people's perception of black people. So I think in some ways I was a benefit that I could sort of not explain, like, you know, white people see this, but there were certain things that, like, that I could maybe express, not like Dave wouldn't know, but I could maybe verify. It was never too awkward.
Can you think of an example of a?
I'm thinking, the ones I'm thinking of are so broad and they're not even good jokes. Like, I'm thinking of one, we had a deal where we wouldn't say who wrote what, but there's some jokes that are just like, who cares? We did a racial draft sketch when Tiger Woods gets drafted.
You have to explain, like, the premise.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. So we did a racial draft where different racial groups draft people that are sort of in between. So Tiger Woods is half Asian and half black. So basically he gets adopted by black people. He gets drafted by black people, and now he's officially black. And we did a bunch of them. Like, the Wu-Tang Clan got drafted by Asians. I think Colin Powell got drafted by white people.
Yes,
I think.
Only if they took Condoleezza Rice too.
That's correct. So I was like, Dave was like, hey, I need, what should I say as Tiger Woods? And I was like, I don't know, goodbye fried rice, hello fried chicken. And it's a decent joke, but it's not anything I'm especially proud of, but it got the job done. It was like a Band-Aid line.
So you were actually on Chappelle's show in a position that a lot of black people are in, which is being the minority person.
You know, yeah.
You were the white person working with Chappelle and with a, you know, largely black cast, and hanging out with a lot of fellow comics who are largely African-American. And I should mention here, your podcast, Champs, only mm-hmm. has on comics of color.
Yes, for the most part, yeah. And a few, it wasn't all black people, but we had a no white people policy.
So I've asked a lot of African-Americans over the years what it's like to be, like, the black person who's, like, integrating the school, or, you mm-hmm. know, the only black person in their class, or the only black person on the job, or the only black writer on the show. So let me ask you the reverse question. What was it like being, like, the white guy?
It was very hard. No, it was great. Like, there was no
more stories of oppression. Yeah.
It was never, there's such a thing as being a minority, but not being oppressed. And I think I was a minority with power, I guess. I was a minority, but I was still the number two guy. So I never felt oppressed. I think my whole goal was just to do right by Dave, because I was thankful for the opportunity, and to do right by black people at large, I think, vis-a-vis Dave.
Let's get back to Three Mics. You talk about mm-hmm. depression in your show. Mm-hmm. At what age did you become aware that other people weren't feeling what you were feeling, that you were sadder than other people? You had a problem most people did not.
It's a good question. You know, when I was a kid, I used to cry every day, like when I was like 7 through 11 or 6 through 11, to the point where my brothers and sisters would, like, there was an ongoing joke where they would make me cry to keep my streak alive of crying every day. pretty great. So I think that's probably an indicator. It never occurred to me, like, you know, this is clinical depression. And I don't even know if it was. I maybe just was a sensitive little kid. But I think probably once I was like an adult and you sort of realize, like, oh, this isn't just like an attitude. This is actual, there may be something clinically happening here. And I think I started taking medication when I was 24.
So you're the youngest of 10 siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about this in your show, Three Mics. Your father was abusive. He was violent. He was an alcoholic. What kind of drunk was he?
He wasn't like a 10 drink guy. He was a 3 drink guy every day, and they would sort of give him and then he would felt deputized to kind of rage or be vitriolic. I think it gave him the confidence to sort of let out his true self, which was kind of nasty and competitive and petty. It was never like fall down, stumbling, slurring drunk. It was just more like bullying drunk.
Did watching your father be a mean drunk affect how you felt about starting to drink? You know,
yeah, like when you became of age? Yeah, I drank a lot in high school. Yeah, no, I drank a lot in high school mostly just to like, I guess just to like fit in. But I've maybe gotten drunk 3 times in my adult life, twice maybe. It just doesn't do anything for me. Like, I, A, like my personality, and B, I need energy. I don't need a depressant.
In your autobiographical monologues in your show Three Mics, you describe your father as a narcissist. Was that your diagnosis?
No, that was a doctor's diagnosis. In true narcissistic fashion, when my father was diagnosed as a narcissist, he called us all up individually to tell us. And he did it with true pride. Like, he was like, hey, I have some, are you sitting down? I have some news. I'm a narcissist. So it was like, it was incredibly ironic. But yeah, he was a proud narcissist. I think he liked it. I think it made him feel like confident in himself. Like, I think he was like, it was somehow affirming to him that like, I knew it. I knew I thought I was great. If that makes sense.
So what does it mean in the official lexicon of psychiatry that you're a narcissist, when you're a narcissist?
I think he, you know, my understanding is no empathy. Mm-hmm. And every single thing is about how it affects you. And every single situation is about you.
Okay, so your father was the father of 10 children, you being
yes.
the youngest.
People who were not him. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, that must be a challenge. Like, you're supposed to have empathy with your children. You're supposed to really care about them, even put them before you many times.
Yeah.
So yeah. It sounds like your father would not.
That's what I've heard, yes.
Sounds like your father was not doing that when he was raising you.
Yeah, he was not an empathetic guy, and he didn't want to have kids. I think ultimately, like, he just didn't want to have kids. I think that's another thing that you weren't even allowed to really admit or acknowledge or live a life based on. Like, you couldn't say, I don't want kids, I don't think. Like, I think most of their my mother and father's life was just like, what's everybody else doing? I guess that's what we have to do. I think my mother was happy to do it. I think my mom loved having 10 kids, but I think my dad hated it, really. I really think he just didn't like it. And he was kind of stuck, you know? Which, you know, is it? He that's how he behaved.
How did that leave you feeling about having children yourself?
Well, Terry, I don't have any. So I think it's pretty clear how it left me feeling. I don't know. I'm not curious. I think it's the same way alcohol affected me. I think I had a similar response to children. Even though I was the youngest, so I can't say like, oh, it was awful, and it was fun in a lot of ways. But I never had like I never got to see like a baby grow up or anything like that. So, but I'm not, it's never occurred to me to have children or to want children.
So, early when you were, I don't know, in your teens or 20s, I mm-hmm. assume this was after you dropped out of film school, mm-hmm. you worked the door at a comedy club in Greenwich Village.
Yes.
So you must have met a lot of comics doing that. I think that's how you met Chappelle, right?
Yeah, that is how I met Dave. But yeah, the average, I mean, this is in the early 90s, so the average, you know, Jon Stewart was around, Ray Romano was around, Louis was around, Dave Attell was around, Chappelle. That was like an average show back then, but none of them were famous.
So how, when you met Chappelle, what clicked and got you working together?
We were the only young guys. We were like both 17 or 18. So I think we had a shared sensibility in terms of, like, whereas I'd gone to film school, we just had similar taste in movies and like what we liked or what we didn't, or things that we thought were hacky or things that we thought were like done to death or whatever. And we would just talk and we'd like walk around for hours.
You had an agreement with Chappelle not to divulge who wrote what.
Yeah.
Why was that important
to
you?
Except for the goodbye, hello, fried chicken joke.
Right.
yeah. That masterpiece. It was important. I knew when we wrote together that he would get all the credit in comedy and I would get all the credit in showbiz. So, like, in comedy clubs, it would be, like, someone's referred to me as Dave's typist in the past. That he would get all the credit because he was a really well-known comedian, and I would get all the credit in showbiz because I was the white had to do with it. I was a white person, so therefore they're predisposed to give me credit over a black guy. And I was also, like, the writer, and in L.A., the writer is, like, the sort of organized taskmaster. And the one who organizes the talent's voice, Dave being the talent. Because people don't want to believe that you're both talented. They want to believe that there's this simple explanation of, like, Neil's Dave's typist, or Dave's this crazy genius that Neil types for, or Neil is this puppet master who is telling Dave what to say and how to say it and where to say it. And both are insulting. So I was like, let's just keep it anonymous so that people can't, you know, kind of divide and conquer. And it's just a respect thing. It's like, how do I keep my respect and how do I keep it so that Dave gets respect?
So since so many sketches were about race, did you and Chappelle have a lot of, like, deep discussions about race?
Yeah. But the thing is, we'd been having them. We'd been having them since 1992, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I knew him when the Rodney King verdict came out. I knew him when the OJ verdict came out. Like, I had dinner with him the night the OJ verdict came out. I remember when Rodney King happened, he was in LA. I remember talking to him, like, that day or the next day. So we'd been having long, deep discussions. It wasn't like, oh, we have a show, we better talk about race. Dave's wife at one point said to Dave, all you and Neil talk about is girls and work, work being race in this case. Like, that's kind of all we would ever talk about. So it was a natural extension of an ongoing conversation.
No, my impression from things I read was that Chappelle at some point thought that white people were misinterpreting the sketches and maybe sometimes, like, laughing at him instead of with him on certain things. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard when something goes out to that broad an audience. You can't control what people make of it. The most troublesome example of this was me and Dave were in, I think, Tempe, Arizona, and we were at a nightclub. And some sort of dusty white dude came up and was like, hey, man, I like that sketch about the blind white supremacist who leaves his wife because she's a lover. And it was just like, ugh. Like, literally, like, even just saying it just now, my like, I get the chills. It so makes me so uncomfortable. And it's one of those things where it's like, so what do you do? Do you stop? You can't control how people interpret things.
Right, and the sketch that you're talking about was about a blind white supremacist who, because he's blind, doesn't realize he's actually black.
Yes, so, it's like,
so
an
he's
eviscerating...
He's insulting his himself without realizing it.
Yes, exactly. He's black and then leaves his wife because she likes black people.
Right, it's the larger thing here is that, like, people who are racist are stupid. They're not seeing.
Yeah, exactly. And sure enough, that's what happened. So there were a few things like that where it's like, you know, what do you do if you're a black artist? And I think a lot of black artists reckon with this, is like, what do? Do you just keep doing your thing and accept that there's going to be a certain amount of the audience that doesn't understand what you're doing at all? Or do you kind of fold it up and go, if you don't, this is too important for you to misinterpret, so I can't risk it, you know? Which in some ways is, I think, the path that Dave took, which is like, I can't deal with this misinterpretation. It means too much to me and it's too painful.
Do you think that's why he kind of left the show and went to South Africa?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was a lot of stuff, but I think that was one of them, yeah.
And
because he went to Africa, and there was a white person. I think I got labeled as that white person. And it was like, no, we were writing sketches the day before. We were fine. Like, we were getting along fine. There was no racial tension between us. But that was a tough situation for me emotionally, too, co-creating a show and then the show just dissolving in a day.
Well, he didn't tell you he was leaving, right?
No, he didn't. And I was on set waiting for him when I found out he was in Africa. I didn't know he was gone until he was gone.
That must have been very strange for you to have something so abrupt and so important. I mean, it was a long friendship.
Yeah, it was painful on a lot of levels. It was painful in that this thing that I made with him was now, I knew when he was gone that the show was over. It wasn't like, oh, he'll come back. Then I just knew, like, okay, that's like, that mean, I know what that means. And yeah, it was painful on a personal level. It had been painful before then, but it wasn't like racially painful. It was just painful. It was kind of personally painful in that when we had to renegotiate with Comedy Central, it was basically a divide and conquer thing. And we were divided and conquered. I think I was conquered. I think there was some contractual stuff that was really painful. And that was more, that was the going to Africa thing was just like the final nail in the coffin.
You had said for a long time that you might become friends again, but you'd probably never work together again. But right after the election, when Chappelle hosted Saturday Night Live, you wrote one of the sketches that he was in. Does it feel good to have Chappelle back in your life?
Yeah, like that's, you know, the thing of you know, Dave's a really funny dude. Not only is he just like, you know, hey, my friend is funny. My friend is like one of the funniest dudes ever. So it's really fun to have that, it's fun to have him in my life. And again, I've known him so long that there's references or allusions or things we can talk about that I've known for 25 years and like real friends. So. Now, it's also funny. It's nice for other people. People are always glad when they see us together.
Because
it like represents something to people.
Like, what do you think it represents?
I think it represents, this is pretty broad, but I think it represents white and black unity for some people. I swear to God, I know that sounds crazy. And I think it represents like, it's like a band that people like to see him together.
Mm-hmm.
I remember like probably a year ago, Dave was showing me and Chris Rock something. So I picked him up and we drove over and Rock was waiting for us and Rock goes, saw us together and he goes, man, this is like seeing Outkast together. So I think it's like this, this broken up band that we kind of come back together.
Well, Neil Brennan, thank you so much for talking with us. I really
Terry,
enjoyed it.
Like I said, couldn't be a bigger fan. This is like a dream come true. So I really, really appreciate you having me on.
Neil Brennan's new Netflix comedy special is called Three Mics. That's M-I-C-S, as in microphones. Our critic at large, John Powers, has a review of the new graphic novel, My Favorite Thing is Monsters, by first-time writer Emil Ferris. It tells the story of a 10-year-old girl who loves horror films and tries to solve the murder of a lovely upstairs neighbor. But the book does a lot more than just that. John calls the book a true revelation.
These days, almost every new movie, show, album, or book feels so anticipated and prepackaged that we're already tired of it by the time it's released. This makes it especially thrilling when something dazzling just appears, like that alien spaceship in Arrival, startling even those whose business it is to be in the know. That's what happened with My Favorite Thing is Monsters, a new graphic novel just out from Fantagraphic Books. The first of two volumes, the second comes out this fall, it's the brainchild of a 55-year-old Chicago illustrator, Emil Ferris. Until she sent off the manuscript, nobody in the comics world had ever heard of her. I certainly hadn't. But this extraordinary book has instantly rocketed Ferris into the graphic novel elite, alongside Art Spiegelman, Alison Bechdel, and Chris Ware. You see, she has produced something rare, a page-turning story whose pages are so brilliantly drawn, you don't want to turn them. My favorite thing is Monsters is set amid the political and racial swirl of uptown Chicago in the late 1960s. It presents itself as the journal of Karen Reyes, a precocious, inquisitive 10-year-old of Mexican, Irish, and Cherokee ancestry. Karen lives with her mother and her older brother, Deez, a tattooed womanizer facing the Vietnam draft, who teaches her about art. A social outcast, Karen loves and identifies with monsters, even romanticizing herself as a werewolf girl, with fangs protruding from her lower jaw. Largely friendless, Karen spends her hours drawing, watching horror movies, going to the museum, and visiting their upstairs neighbor, Anka, a lovely but reckless Holocaust survivor, who reminds me of Isabella Rossellini in Blue Velvet. When Anka is murdered, Karen sets about trying to find the killer, a search that sends the book back to Nazi Germany and leads Karen to suspect everyone, from Anka's jazz man husband to their ventriloquist neighbor to, and could it be possible, her own beloved brother. If this sounds like a wild story, so is the tale of how Ferris came to write it. She was a 40-year-old single mom who supported herself doing illustrations when she was bitten by a mosquito. She contracted West Nile virus, became paralyzed from the waist down, and lost the use of her drawing hand. Fighting chronic pain, she taught herself to draw again, then reinvented herself as a graphic novelist, spending 6 long years creating what's clearly an emotional autobiography. And man, does her commitment show. Breaking away from the panel format customary in comics, Ferris's densely imagined, cross-hatched images explode with a visual freedom I've not seen in a graphic novel. And she uses that freedom to give us, well, everything. We see Karen's inner and outer world, which is just bursting with stuff. Her gothic dreams, her family's story, the murder of Martin Luther King, ruminations on race and class and gender, portraits of kinky sex in Weimar Germany, hand-drawn copies of classic paintings, complete with art history lessons, and even spectacular magazine covers for imaginary horror magazines with titles like Ghastly. Ferris uses all of this to explore the idea of monstrousness, from the small-scale cruelties of schoolyard bullying to Nazi death camps. Along the way, Karen learns to see a difference between what she calls good monsters, who are scary because they're, quote, weird-looking and fangy, and so-called bad monsters. They're scary because they want everyone to be scared so they can control them. For all its stylistic tour de forciness, My Favorite Thing is Monsters is filled with emotion. And while the material is often dark, the book is strangely affirmative. This is partly because of its affection for oddballs, which harks back to the work of R. Crumb, and partly because its pages brim with Karen's genuine love for her mother and her brother, for her gritty neighborhood, for monster movies, and for the magic of art, which lets her transform and transcend her often hard daily life. Ferris clearly knows all of Karen's emotions from deep within. Every page feels like it's been secreted from the very core of her being. In one of his essays, Montaigne wrote, "I have never seen a greater monster or miracle in the world than myself." Ferris would surely agree.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed My Favorite Thing is Monsters by Emil Ferris. The American government turned against some of America's most talented filmmakers and actors after World War II, accusing them of being communists or communist sympathizers. The so-called subversives were called to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee, HUAC, where they were asked to confess to communist ties and give the names of others in Hollywood they suspected of being communists. Anyone who didn't cooperate was put in jail or on a blacklist that would make it impossible to work in Hollywood. My guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and former Washington Post reporter Glenn Frankel, has written a new book called High Noon about the Hollywood blacklist and the making of the 1952 classic Western High Noon. The film's screenwriter, Carl Foreman, was one of the people called before HUAC and had to decide whether to violate his principles by complying or face the consequences. He intended High Noon to serve as an allegory about blacklisting. The film stars Gary Cooper as the marshal of the small town Hadleyville. Hours after marrying a young Quaker, he learns that a killer he sent to prison, Frank Miller, has been released and is on the noon train heading to town, where three of his gang members are waiting for him. The marshal knows they will try to kill him, and he faces a difficult choice: retire and leave town with his new wife, as they planned, or stand up for his principles and stay, knowing he may be killed. He decides to stay, but it's going to be him against four gunmen, so he'll need the help of the townsmen. But he slowly learns no one is willing to take a risk to help him. In this scene from early in the film, his wife, played by Grace Kelly, pleads with him to leave town with her.
Will, I'm begging you, please let's go.
I can't.
Don't try to be a hero. You don't have to be a hero, not for me.
I'm not trying to be a hero. If you think I like this, you're crazy. Look, Amy, this is my town. I've got friends here. I'll swear in a bunch of special deputies, and with a posse behind me, maybe there won't even be any trouble.
You know there'll be trouble.
Then it's better to have it here. I'm sorry, honey. I know how you feel about it.
Do you?
Of course I do. I know it's against your religion, though. Sure, I know how you feel.
But you're doing it just the same. Oh, Will, we were married just a few minutes ago. We've got our whole lives ahead of us. Doesn't that mean anything to you?
You know, I've only got an hour, and I've got lots to do. Stay at the hotel until it's over.
No, I won't be here when it's over. You're asking me to wait an hour to find out if I'm going to be a wife or a widow. I say it's too long to wait. I won't do it.
Amy.
I mean it. If you won't go with me now, I'll be on that train when it leaves here.
I've got to stay.
Glenn Frankel, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you see any parallels between today and the story you're telling about the blacklisting of people in the film industry accused of being communists or communist sympathizers?
Yes, I do. I think that the blacklist movement stems out of what you might consider a backlash in politics in the late 1940s and early 50s after World War II has ended and the Cold War has begun. And that sense of backlash by people who felt disenfranchised, if you will, during the time of the New Deal and now have the opportunity to come back into politics after the war has ended and Franklin Roosevelt is dead. That sense that they want to get their country back, that they feel it's been usurped from them by outsiders. In those days, it was communists and Jews and liberals. Today, you might say it's Islamic terrorists and undocumented immigrants. A similar sense that someone has taken their country away and they need to claw it back. And it creates a political movement that creates, takes advantage of the Cold War atmosphere and the anxiety in society and lashes back. And that's exactly what we saw in the late 40s. And I think you can see a lot of similarities to what's going on now with the ascendancy of Donald Trump and a sort of new neo-populist movement.
Do you see any connection between the fears of Hollywood then and its like leftist orientation to the accusations today that Hollywood is liberal?
Well, Hollywood was founded by the Jews, not to put too fine a point on it. Most of the studios were created by guys who were either, and they were all guys at the time, who either were immigrants themselves from Eastern Europe or whose parents were. And they came to Hollywood and invented this American empire, this empire of dreams, if you will. And so, you know, they were essentially very patriotic, but at the same time, liberal in outlook. And of course, it attracted so many thousands of talented people and a lot of writers who tended to be on the left. We're talking about the evolution of Hollywood, for example, through the Great Depression. And these folks come there, immigrants, refugees from Europe, add their own views to the mix. And so there is a sense of Hollywood as a place where progressives are comfortable. And that's the assumption that's made. And that's exactly what the committee and the FBI go after and nail then. I think the atmosphere is a little different now. Hollywood still has a very liberal, progressive sort of tinge to it. People are a little less frightened these days, I would say, about offering their opinions.
High Noon was released in 1952. Carl Foreman, the screenwriter, who's the main character in your book, initially intended to make a Western that would be a parable about the post-World War II world and the importance of the new United Nations. But after The Blacklist started, he decided to make High Noon a parable about the blacklisting era. So in what sense do you see and did he see High Noon as a parable about that era?
Well, Carl talked about this later. Of course, he didn't say anything about it at the time
because
it would have been dangerous to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you basically see it in the way he treats the community. This is set in the fictional place called Hadleyville, which sounds a lot like Hollywood. And what the good citizens of Hadleyville do when faced with the threat coming on the train, you know, this bad guy who used to run the town is coming back and he's got three thugs waiting for him, and they're going to seek out and kill the marshal, the lawman who had resisted them and put him in jail years earlier. The lawman, Will Kane is his name in the film, played by Gary Cooper, thinks he can rely on the community the same way he did originally when they imprisoned these guys. To support him. But he finds, and the core of the movie is him going around from place to place and person to person and to the church during a service and finding that the community is not backing him. There's a sort of moral corruption going on. There's a cowardice. And he ends up standing alone. And that's exactly, I think, the point that Carl was trying to make, that Hollywood, when faced with these gunmen, thugs, whatever you want to call them, of the committee coming back to Hollywood, didn't stand up. He found himself being shunned, friends crossed the street to avoid talking to him. His partners in the little film production company that created High Noon, and that was a very creative and interesting little group of people led by Stanley Kramer, he found himself suddenly facing a challenge from them. At first, they were very supportive, but as time went on and Carl faced a subpoena, they were concerned. What are you going to say when you go before the committee? Are you going to take the Fifth Amendment? Because if you do that and you refuse to testify, we're going to be tainted as well. So Carl saw this turning against him and this sense of cowardice, as he interpreted it. And that's what he wrote into High Noon. And that's what makes it, that's the sort of political tinge to it, this kind of anti-populist turn of the movie that makes it different than a lot of Westerns and gives it the sting that I think Carl was looking for.
Yeah, and one of the points of the movie is that people don't have the courage to stand up for justice and truth. They don't want to take risks.
Exactly.
So Carl Foreman, the screenwriter of High Noon, was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee. What did they think they had on him?
Well, earlier that summer, they had found a witness, a man named Martin Berkeley, who was a screenwriter, and who had been a member of the Communist Party and then had turned and became a guy who named names. And he not only named 5 or 10 or 15 names like some of the previous witnesses, he named 150 people. And Carl was one of those. They already had their eyes on Carl because there had been a previous committee in the California legislature that had singled out people. But this time, they really had him nailed. And so Carl had been Carl was a minor figure in 47, but by 1951, he'd been nominated for 2 Academy Awards for screenplays that he'd written. Later, he'd be nominated for a third for High Noon. So he was suddenly a much more prominent figure and a real target. So they wanted him to come there and tell them about his previous membership in the Communist Party, which he'd been in the late 30s and early 40s. And they wanted him to name names. And they saw the opportunity there with Carl of getting more of the kind of stuff they had gotten from Martin Berkeley.
So had he been a member of the Communist Party?
He had indeed. He and his wife Estelle, when they came out to Hollywood in 1938, had fairly quickly joined the party. Remember, we're talking about the tail end of the Great Depression. We're talking about a time when the progressive movement was in alliance with the small American Communist Party. And he saw the Communist Party, as a lot of his fellow members did, as a force that was fighting fascism, that was fighting for civil rights, all kinds of things. Gradually, he soured on it, and he eventually left for good at the end of World War II. Nonetheless, he had friends in the party. He didn't disagree with many of their positions. He saw himself as an American patriot, but as a progressive. So he was put in a very difficult situation because He wasn't in the party anymore. He didn't want to risk his wonderful career, which was just reaching its height. But at the same time, he didn't want to name names. He didn't want to rat out the people who he had been close to. So he's left in the horns of a terrible dilemma. And I found Carl so interesting in part because, you know, he's not a big hero. He's not up there trying to be a martyr. He's just trying to figure out a way to get through this and still be an honorable person. In many ways, just like the lawman in High Noon.
So Gary Cooper, the iconic star of High Noon, is very conservative, anti-communist. What was his reaction when Carl Foreman, the screenwriter, was called to testify before HUAC?
Well, you have to remember that Cooper was 50 years old and at the stage of his career where he was kind of desperate for good parts. The studio system was beginning to fall apart. He was the ultimate product of the studio system in many ways, and he had prospered under it. But the scripts weren't as good anymore, and the people he was working with, he didn't have the same respect for. He loved the High Noon script. He thought it was very powerful, very suspenseful. So when Carl came to him, they'd already worked together for a while here, and Cooper, like a lot of folks, was very sort of intuitive. Yes, he had strong beliefs, but at the same time, having worked closely with this guy, he liked him. He trusted him. He said, look, I knew you were, you know, left wing, you and Kramer, but I trust you. If you tell me you're not in the party anymore and, you know, you've been honest with me and I don't want to give this up, so I'm going to support you. And he did support Carl, both at that moment in insisting that Carl be kept on the movie. And then afterwards, when Carl was blacklisted, Cooper even agreed to try to help him form a new production company. So Cooper supports him, does his best to stay with him.
So what was Carl Foreman's approach to testifying before the committee?
Well, he gets there, and he is rather coy, I would say. He says, I'm not a member of the Communist Party now. And he says that by saying, look, last year, everyone in the Screenwriters Guild in the executive board were required to fill out a loyalty oath. And I signed a loyalty oath then saying I wasn't a member of the party. That statement is still true. But that's as far as he would go. He wouldn't denounce the Communist Party. When asked repeatedly if he'd been a member before he signed the oath, say in the 1940s, he cited the Fifth Amendment against incriminating himself. He simply wouldn't play the game, and this put him on very dangerous ground. You can't really cite the Fifth Amendment unless you answer every question with it. Once you breach that, you're running into the possibility of being charged with contempt of Congress. But nonetheless, that's the way he maneuvered. I think he knew, or he came to know, that this wouldn't work, that it might keep him from going to jail, but it wouldn't keep him from the blacklist.
So what were the consequences for him of not fully testifying and of not naming names?
Well, as of the newspaper coverage, you know, headlines the next day said that he had refused to cooperate. And that same day, the Stanley Kramer Company, which was now, in a production deal with Columbia Pictures, Columbia issued a statement in Stanley's name saying, you know, I have a great disagreement with Carl Foreman, and we're going to have to sit down our company and decide what to do about it, but we have to take steps. So basically, they disowned Carl the day after the testimony, and over the course of the next month or so, Carl's lawyer and their lawyer sat down and worked out a severance agreement. It allowed him to keep his credit for the screenplay. That would have been very hard to take away from him. But it took away his associate producer's credit because he and Zinnemann had been doing High Noon, not just on their own, but they were the principals in it. And so he got a severance deal, and a pretty good one, but he really lost his control over the film. And for all intents and purposes, that was the end of his Hollywood career.
He self-exiled to England, and then his passport was revoked except for travel back to the U.S., and so there were real serious consequences he paid.
Absolutely. I mean, he was one of thousands. Many people lost their passports and weren't allowed to travel. It took years for the courts to reverse the State Department's process on that. So he was faced. He was out there in England. He had his settlement. You know, he was living well, but he was isolated. And he couldn't use his own name on the scripts. The most egregious case of that is when he and Michael Wilson, another blacklisted writer, write the screenplay for The Bridge on the River Kwai. And the screenplay is nominated and wins an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. But the credit goes to Pierre Boulle, the French novelist who had written the original novel and who didn't speak English. And it's only many, many years later that Wilson and Forman are recognized as the true authors. For Carl, this was enormously damaging to his psyche, to his spirit. He really felt that he was an outsider. And one of the things that's so fascinating about The Blacklist to me, Terry, is the intimacy of it, the way it divided families, the impact it had on close friends like Kramer and Forman. You know, you expect to have conflicts with your enemy. I mean, the right wing versus the left wing and all that, the committee. But the really damaging and heavy-duty emotional damage was between friends and within families and, you know, former business partnerships. Carl had a lot of trouble getting over that. He could forgive his enemies, and he did forgive a number of people who had gone after him, but he could never talk to Stanley Kramer again. And so this really aided him. Even when he had a very successful later run in his career, he never really got over the fact that he had been purged at the height of his success in Hollywood.
Glenn Frankel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's been a real pleasure.
Glenn Frankel is the author of High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist, and The Making of an American Classic. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Muj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.